do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Greetings and welcome back to the DNA of Purpose podcast, the place where we empower you to build trust, champion adaptability, and cultivate the courage to unleash your unique DNA of purpose. Right now, the COP28 Climate Summit is happening in Dubai, a space where the most important discussions around climate change are in full motion, where world leaders, scientists, and environmentalists are discussing strategies for the best ways to efficiently mitigate climate change in the coming years. And these discussions are critical because recent data warns us of the potential to surpass the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming threshold. Clearly, we are already entering a danger zone. The thing is, for some leaders, they may be aware of the numbers, but that is not necessarily translating to the immediate action required to break down the story that a business's sole purpose is to make a profit. And the truth is that if we as leaders don't break down that story, the planet is very likely to burn it up for us. Surely, it is wise to be on the front foot at such an important time. The point worth noting is that it's easy for leaders to talk up their company's environmental credentials and social values, but there's a big difference between businesses that are less bad and companies which actually make the world better. Companies who, in other words, have a net positive impact. So, what is a net positive impact? Let me introduce you to today's guest. His name is Andrew Winston, and he is a globally recognized expert on megatrends and how to build companies that thrive by serving the world. His views on sustainable business strategy have been sought after by many of the world's most prominent companies. He was selected for the Thinkers 50 list of the top management thinkers in the world, and Andrew has also appeared in major media such as Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, Time, Business Week, New York Times, and CNBC. He happened to be the author of the Harvard Business Review magazine cover story, The Net Positive Manifesto, and the HBR Big Idea cover story, Leading a New Era of Climate Action. Now, Andrew has written several books on sustainability. However, his latest book, written in conjunction with one of the world's most prominent purpose-driven CEOs, Paul Polman from Unilever, is the topic of today's conversation. In short, Andrew and Paul quite literally explode 50 years of corporate dogma. Business, they say, can no longer focus solely on short-term profits or ignore humanity's biggest challenges. Net Positive lays out the principles and practices of next-generation companies that deliver the scale of change and transformation that the world desperately needs. And today, that is exactly what we will be exploring. How can you become a net positive leader? So without further delay, welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Andrew Winston, welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you beaming into the studio here this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to visit you virtually.
Thank you so much for joining me. Now, I'm going to kick off with a question that I ask all of my guests. As you can imagine, I get to ask a lot of questions on this podcast, and I'm always fascinated to understand what great questions these people who I'm interviewing, incredible people, ask themselves. And so I'm curious to know, What question are you currently pondering that is guiding your work forward at this particular point in time?
It's an interesting question. Well, I guess there's always the kind of personal questions of, you know, am I having the impact? What's, you know, what's my purpose? You know, I'm sure we'll get to this, but my latest book, Net Positive, you know, poses this question, is the world better off because your business is in it? So that's kind of an ongoing question, you know, I pose to companies, but I find myself personally, you know, at times asking, is the world better off because of my work, because I've been in it? So that's kind of the personal one. Professionally, I think, you know, I've been increasingly focused on, you know, what's slowing down purpose and sustainability. Why do companies not do more, go faster? And I think there's this story or narrative that we're stuck in. And so I kind of have this question about how do we break a dominant framing, a dominant story? How do you, you know, identify it and write a new story? Because we're stuck in one that says that, you know, the purpose of business is to profit in the short run and make as much money as it can. And the purpose of society or government is to have high GDP, right? And high stock market. And so there's this story that we live in. And so I'm constantly asking, how do we write a new one?
Andrew, what I'm really interested to understand is, as I mentioned before the podcast, I first came across your work probably around 2 decades now, and it's clear to say that the sustainability space has evolved in the most incredible of ways in that time. Now, I've got your book, Net Positive, on my desk, and in the book, You and the co-author of the book, formerly the CEO of Unilever, Paul Polman, brilliantly tie together 3 major trends, being the climate consciousness of millennials and Gen Z, the push for transparency due to the digital revolution, and exponential progress, all obviously underscored by the urgency for climate action. So I'm wondering if you could share with me how these trends are driving the net positive movement today, given it's really moving so fast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I hope it's driving the net positive movement. You know, we're not moving fast enough. That's part of what drove us to kind of put this manifesto, I guess, and an action plan into the world, that the problems are really big. Climate is getting away from us still. So the leading companies really need to go beyond just trying to reduce their emissions a bit and think in a much, much broader way about the systems they're a part of and how do we improve the well-being of everyone we touch? How do we make money by, you know, by solving the world's problems, not by causing them? So, I mean, look, the world is really intertwined. I think it's this realization that's dawning on people. There's, you know, a lot of people talking about what's called the poly crisis or the multi crisis, you know, this idea that there's inequality and there's climate and there's biodiversity loss and there's attacks on democracy, that they're all kind of related. And that's part of what makes it really challenging, you know, that these things do feed each other and they are accelerating. We've been moving really at an exponential rate on, you know, growth of people, growth of the amount of stuff we use, you know, growth of our problems. And it's still moving really, really rapidly. The good news, I guess, is that there's some exponential trends like how cheap renewable energy and batteries and you know, cars, electric cars are becoming. So we've got some good news on the exponential, but it's this fact that they kind of feed each other that I think is both really dangerous, but also maybe create some opportunities, because if they're all connected, then working on one of them, you know, with a mindset of how they're all connected, can solve multiple things at once, right? So that's the good part of it all being connected. But I think it is driving business to really have to say something about the big issues of the day. Now, multinationals don't have much choice but to say something about climate and inequality and racial justice and LGBTQ and democracy and misinformation. They're being asked to by stakeholders, their employees expect it, young people expect it. It's just part of being a business today. And so that is driving some self-reflection in these companies to have to, you know, take some stands. And that is, I think, driving them to a new place to think about their role in a deeper way and how they can improve the well-being of everyone that they impact.
And that need is certainly something that has been met by net positive the book and the ideas that you were conveyed. I think it would be really helpful for our listeners if we could at this point unpack the essential principles of a net positive business model. So I'm wondering, can you break down the key elements for us, particularly emphasizing how we can live out the principle, if you break the world, you own it. What does that actually look like in practical terms?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have kind of five key principles that we think go beyond, you know, normal excellence. And, you know, it's about taking a long-term view, taking a multi-stakeholder view, not just shareholders. It's also serving shareholders, but kind of because you're doing the other things right. And it's about transformative partnership. Mm-hmm. And the fifth, and but really the first one we talk about is what you said, which is really ownership. And it's responsibility, but not really the way that corporate responsibility has been referred to or used for years. It is responsibility the way you kind of teach your kids. That's why we use the line, if you break it, you own it. You know, it's the idea you go into a store, you break something, it's kind of yours. And we have kind of cracked the world, you know, the business community, all of us as consumers, all 8 billion of us. I mean, the whole system, right, is cracking the ability of the planet to support us. So what we're suggesting is that companies can no longer say, well, that's not my problem because it happens at my suppliers, or my customers take my product and they're going to do what they do with it. It's not my issue. That you have to look at your full, you know, value chain in the kind of wonky terms of business, which means where are you getting the stuff that you make your products or services with? Who makes it? Were they paid a living wage? What's their footprint? Like, this is all part of your responsibility. And it's something that especially younger people, younger buyers, younger employees, they just expect, right? That it is your issue. It is your choices as a business as well. Even though it's not in your control directly, right? That you have to work in conjunction with the other parts of your value chain. So it's taking responsibility for the impacts you have, whether they're intended or not. And then saying, okay, what would we do about those? What's the best way for us to tackle that?
And so if we have leaders who are taking responsibility and really leaning into this net positive business model, we now have something which is called ESGs. Now, this might seem like a really obvious question, but I'd really love to get inside, what are ESGs and how are they set? And what is the recommended process for achieving those targets within an organization? How do we make them real?
Well, so just kind of definitionally, ESG is environmental, social, and governance. It's an acronym, you know, in and of itself, it doesn't say much. It just tells you here's some categories of things that a company needs to be looking at. But it's really an acronym from the financial world. They use it to talk about the things that might impact a company, that might create risk for it, that could affect it as an investment, right? And that is not the same thing really as sustainability. There's similar concepts, but sustainability is more about the role of business in society, how business affects the problems, makes them better or worse. And it's not just the investor view. So the ESG movement has risen, the investors are at the table. And so they're driving much more discussion of these three categories of things. And they're driving, you know, and kind of encouraging some regulation that's been growing, especially in the EU, that's forcing companies more and more to be transparent about these things. And in the categories, you know, what's in environment is your footprint, your water use, you know, your impact on energy and climate and waste. In the social is your impact on people and, you know, wages and communities. And, you know, it varies quite a bit by sector. And the G part is getting more attention, which is governance, which is, do you have any control over this process? Does your board know what it's doing? Do you have a sustainability committee on the board? Are the management, you know, leaders paid for doing more on sustainability? So there's these kind of categories that companies increasingly kind of have to look at and report on as part of their normal reporting of risk and you know, what's called materiality in business, and have to have something kind of intelligent to say about them.
And I mean, what is your gut feel? Do you think ESGs will fundamentally amplify net positive business models? Is it something that you support?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of debate about it. There's people in the sustainability community who are really not happy with the ESG movement as it comes from finance. They think the banks in particular are kind of faking it. And, you know, they've been launching these funds, and there's trillions of dollars in them that are supposedly screening companies. And critics have pointed out, rightly so, that, like I said, it's really an assessment from finance and banks on whether the company has some risk, which is not the same thing as saying the company's sustainable. So Exxon can get a decent rating sometimes if they're managing some of their risk with climate change, which is kind of ludicrous, right? Because their impact on the world has been, you know, pretty dramatic and negative. And, you know, so there's really deep concerns, and I share some of those. I think the investor view isn't really the right one on this. It's part of, you know, the pure investor view is kind of how we got into this deep problem in the first place. We put profits and, you know, short-term performance above all. So But that said, I've been working for 20 years to get companies more engaged. And what was kind of missing was investors. So you could have a CFO or a CEO who said, I care about the planet, but my investors don't care. So even if the investors aren't really asking the right questions, or the ESG thing isn't quite well defined yet, I think it's still been a good thing that investors are at the table, because it forces companies to look at stuff, to do more, to measure more. And when you measure something, you probably do better at managing it, right? So it brings it at least to the table. But, you know, ESG right now is kind of anarchy. It's the metrics are all over the place. The companies that rate companies, it's not easy, right? It's not kind of as clean as people think, you know, financial statements are, even though they're not really super clean either. There's lots of fudging in the money side too. But you know, sustainability has a bunch of things that are hard to measure. And so that makes it hard to rate. But it's early times in a lot of ways. And so I think in general, it's a good thing that they're all at the table now.
Absolutely. And I guess on the other hand, I mean, it's great to be setting targets, but the real question is, how do you execute on those targets? How do you actually integrate some of these practices? And so I'm wondering, what does a net positive leader look like? What are the specific skills and personality attributes that truly allow a leader to integrate these changes within an organization?
Yeah, I mean, we lay out in the book kind of five key attributes, and the core is really courage, and that's in the subtitle of the book, that you really need courage because you are going against the grain. We've had this system in place that's been kind of unquestioned for 50 years of, you know, short-term profits above all. And you do have to question that to try to build, I think, a better, more resilient business that serves the world better. So it takes courage, and it takes courage to push back on the system. It also takes kind of your own personal sense of purpose. We start the book, the parts of the book that say, here's how you build this kind of company. We start with the person and start with the question, how much do you care? You know, kind of an internal reflection of, how much do you care about the problems that, you know, there's a billion people that don't have enough food. There's, you know, climate is imploding. How much do you care? And what's your purpose at work? What's your purpose of business? How does it connect to the purpose of the place you're working at? So there's this kind of internal, drive and duty, I think, to the world. And then there's other things like, you know, some level of humility, which we don't normally reward that well, I think, in business, but humility in the face of really big challenges, in the face of, you know, outside NGOs and stakeholders that might know more about something. And, you know, the humility to say, hey, we don't know how to solve this problem alone. You know, we need some help. And that takes courage too. So I think it's those kinds of attributes and a real collaborative spirit, you know, the belief that we really need to partner to do this and to be open to that. Those are the kind of key things I think we see in the leaders that are getting there.
Now, obviously, you co-authored Net Positive with Paul Polman, one of the most prominent purpose-driven leaders on the planet. However, I'm curious to know, outside of Paul, have you got any examples or case studies of leaders who are really leaning into Net Positive influence in a really compelling and impactful way?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting, though, is, you know the famous books by Jim Collins, like Good to Great, and, you know, he talks and really pushed this idea of a level five leader, right? Which is someone who, it's not about them, right? And he talks about building a clock, not telling the time, like building the system. And that's kind of Paul, I think. You know, Paul's famous because he was a CEO of a big company, but is pretty modest, is a fairly humble guy, is a real guy. And I think there's a lot of those leaders around, but what makes that interesting is you don't always know who they are. Like the ones who are really good at this stuff often are pretty quiet, right? They're just going about doing their work. And you kind of see sometimes a series of leaders in the companies that get it because the company's built, the clock is built, like this is what they're doing. So I think there's been a series of executives at the companies that have gone the furthest, like IKEA, right? There's been a series of CEOs at Patagonia that get it and are on mission, being inspired in part by the Patagonia founder, Yvon Chouinard, who's probably the most purpose-driven leader and kind of incredible, most reluctant businessman. You know, he's like the most reluctant businessman on the planet with this billion-dollar, you know, revenue company. You know, so he's been, I think, a real leader. And I think you see, you know, leaders that have then kind of jumped in and out of business. There's one of the leaders we talk about in the book, Ajay Banga, ran MasterCard and really focused a lot in that company on well-being and livelihoods, and now runs the World Bank. Like, that's a really interesting transition to putting his belief in kind of decency and purpose into, you know, one of the most influential institutions in the world, you know, and so he did that both in business and now in this, you know, quasi-government, quasi-financial institution. So I think there's a handful of people like that. And in the book, I'll just, one last example that I give is the a guy named Ed Stack, who is the CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods in the US. And after one of the horrible, you know, massacres in the US, he realized that they were selling guns and selling the kinds of guns that people were using to kill kids in school. And so he drastically reduced their gun sales. He got death threats, you know, he lost customers, but it really was this incredible moment, you know, for his company to take on what was something like an eighth of their business and potentially wipe it out. So there's examples like that where companies really stand up, and for the most part, they've done really well in the long run, these companies that stand for something. And we're in a really tough time where companies are under pressure in the US in particular, and some have been beaten up and some are taking that as a sign that you shouldn't stick your neck out. But I don't think that's true. I think the courageous generally do well. They get a good following, both their employees and customers.
Certainly. And my hope is that we hear more of those stories as well from those CEOs, because, you know, I think that is what will go on to inspire younger leaders to really step up and lean into net positive business. While on the subject of, I guess, quote unquote, future of work, I'm really curious to understand whether you believe that sustainability will continue to be kind of a silo in business rather than something that really sits underneath the entire organizational change or transformation. To give you an example, one of the things that I've really been pondering is this kind of disconnection between sustainability and hybrid working. Now, I know a lot of leaders at the moment are really resisting remote working. They don't like it. They want people back in the office. In fact, some people are even incentivizing people to come back into the office. Yet at the same time, there's other data showing that hybrid work models could slash carbon emissions by up to 70% in the UK and 87% in the US, which is huge. Considering this juxtaposition, I'm sure, you know, there are other obvious gaps or opportunities like this example. Do you believe that leaders need to make bolder decisions to really disrupt this business as usual paradigm?
Yeah. I mean, well, I'd be interested to see the data on that, on the reductions. I assume that's kind of from transportation or commuting or something. It's can't be for the whole economy, but yeah. I think it's got a good lever there to try to reduce emissions if people are working at home.
I can,
it's going to be really
that.
Interesting to see how this
research.
Plays out. Yeah, no, I'd love to see it. I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out with Gen Z not wanting to work in offices for the most part and wanting flexibility.
Exactly.
And they're increasingly, you know, part of the workforce. So I think, you know, I got lost on the commuting thought in my head. What was the question?
Well, it was just looking at these sort of gaps, essentially. Yeah. You know, like looking at, you know, you've got CEOs who on one hand are going, we want everyone back in the office, you know, we need to foster collaboration, connection. But actually there's this huge opportunity to slash carbon emissions in a solution that's already happening.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, you're right. You need leaders who are willing to challenge the status quo more. We need that across. I mean, you talked about the paradigm. I mean, we're in one really strong paradigm that's it's so deep and accepted that most people can't even see it, that that does say business, its only purpose is profit, and that the purpose of government is, you know, to increase GDP, right? Increase the stock market. These are the dimensions, and it takes some courage and I think some independence of thought to step back and say, is that right? Is that really the best way forward? Is that healthy for us? And I think, you know, questioning the way we work right now is tough. It's unclear to me, in a way, why so many companies are pushing people to come back. Like, do they have really clear evidence that productivity is higher, that, you know, that you get some more creativity? Maybe. But I feel like it's a little bit just, as you say, that's just what they know. It's a little more just kind of traditionalist. When I think younger employees think, if I get my work done, what difference does it make if I'm there, or if I do it from 7 to 3 or, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever? I just think there's a tension building here. But yeah, I mean, we need leaders that question the way things have been done, because we're driving off a cliff. You know, the planet is kind of imploding. So we have to change something pretty fundamentally about the way we operate.
So, Andrew, given the focus of this podcast is all about purpose, I'd really love to dive into the space in between sustainability, ESG implementation, and an organization's purpose. First off, do you see a connection in how these targets, like sustainability targets, are executed within a company and the core organizational purpose, or do you consider that to be two different things? Because on one hand, we've got, you know, one purpose, which is this overarching direction, yet on the other hand, we've got a lot of problems that need to be solved. Do you think we need like a more adaptable approach to purpose?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Look, the number of companies that, I mean, you mentioned earlier, the sustainability is kind of on the side and we didn't really get into that, but the reality is almost every company, the sustainability plan, if there is one, is on the side. It's, you know, there might be a fairly senior sustainability exec, but they don't usually have a lot of budget, a lot of people. I mean, that's part of what made, you know, when Paul got to Unilever and made the sustainable living plan the strategy really of the business, that was what was kind of unusual. And you still don't see it that often. So there is kind of this disconnect. And part of the reason is, you know, going back again to the paradigm we're in or the story we're in, it's still basically assumed that sustainability is kind of, if not anti-business, it's more philanthropy, or it always costs more. And we can unpack that because it's kind of a weird, I think, really dated assumption. But it means that it sits on the side generally. And getting it really ingrained is really kind of the mission of my work. And making it, like many other things in business, just something you do. Like if someone said, are we going to, you know, try to do things with safety as one of our core principles, who's going to say no? Right. But safety was a movement decades ago, and quality, right? There's all these things that became the norm in business. We had, you know, child labor was normal 100+ years ago. And then over time and laws and work, it became the norm to not have that and to work very hard to make sure there's not child labor in your supply chain, even though there still is. Right. So we need different norms. Absolutely. And we need to integrate this so that sustainability is no longer this thing on the side, and it's not the solution to every big problem. It's not the reason that something fails. If something doesn't go right, it's just a part of doing business, and it's a better way of doing business, but it should be more and more taken for granted. That's to me the goal.
So do you think then sustainability should kind of be built into our approach to, say, human resources, where you're working with employees to really help them to get clear on how they enable meaning in the workplace and find fulfillment through aligning what they do to a greater cause, or aligning what they do to solving the solution, you know, finding the solutions that we're talking about, and that it should be you know, sustainability should be viewed through that organizational transformation approach as opposed to, you know, something tacked on the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to continue for a second on the previous question about integrating with purpose, it's worth saying, I think, that purpose in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean sustainability. We always take it to mean something good, but you know, arguably Philip Morris has a purpose, which is if you want to smoke, you can smoke. There's companies producing the weapons of the world, and they believe they're helping protect the world. Like, some of them made the case after the Ukraine invasion that by providing arms to the good guys, that was an ESG move. There were actual weapons makers saying that. So it doesn't inherently mean values necessarily. I think what we're seeing more and more now is that companies are increasingly trying to tie what the business does at core, the very basic thing of, you know, we dig a hole and get metals out, or we produce, you know, food or whatever, and tie it to a purpose that has some good for the world, right? We help make the world, you know, work better, move better. Like, that's what you're seeing more and more of, these kind of purpose statements. And you're not going to really integrate that in a deep way unless you integrate it, as you say, into HR, into people's jobs. HR has been, I think, one of the least focused on areas in sustainability. And I think that is changing, and it's a shame, because I think it's really, really critical that you're hiring with sustainability in mind and the skills you want people to have, that you're incentivizing people, that they get promoted for doing the right thing on these, you know, on these issues and helping the company meet their goals, and that you're building it into compensation, right? You're building it into pay and all of those things. So you need HR. And part of HR is learning and development. And I've spent a lot more time this year developing some classes to try to upskill, you know, help companies and executives understand these issues more. That's a really critical role for HR and learning and development, is getting people on board and giving them kind of fluency in what this climate change issue really means for business, and what inequality means, you know, really understanding the issues and then bringing them into your strategy. And that requires, you know, some of the key skills of HR.
So, Andrew, in your book, you delve into blowing up boundaries to foster innovative thinking in business. And that concept really resonated with me, because what I'm really interested to understand is how we go about breaking down one of the most challenging boundaries, and that is the shift from a traditional growth-centric kind of capitalist model to a more sustainable, circular approach across all facets of business. So, you know, obviously, I think people are talking more about how to create more circularity in production. But again, to the point we just made, how do we create this kind of circular thinking in every aspect of the organizational structure? So in your experience, what boundaries need to be broken down to transition from a more hierarchical system to a more circular and sustainable way of thinking and conducting business?
Yeah, I mean, the boundaries we talk about in the book, where they kind of start with the boundaries in your mind. And part of, I mean, I said before, sustainability should be treated like quality and like marketing and other things in business. But where it really does differ is that it's kind of outside in, right? That you have to look at the thresholds of the world, the context of the work you're doing. You know, climate change is an issue for the world. So bringing that into your business is about the world. It's not about your own internal capabilities, right? So you have to bring this outside in and bring the skills of understanding the issues that we face, understanding systems, and understanding, you know, what circular looks like and what's the current paradigm. There's been people, you know, writing and putting out ideas about this for a very long time, that, you know, like McDonough and Brongard, who wrote Cradle to Cradle. And, you know, the idea that there's no away. We say we're throwing something away. There's no away. It goes somewhere. And so there's this kind of boundary in our head, or this mindset of linear thinking, linear economies, right? You dig up a hole, get some metal, you make it into a piece, it goes into a car, you know, and it keeps going. And then eventually it's like in a landfill, right? So we have to kind of break that mode, because they're just, we don't have infinite resources. And you have to, I think, then change a bunch of mindsets about how do we compete? How do we work with each other? Because making things circular is difficult. And it requires value chain. It requires you to work with your peers, your competitors, with your suppliers, with waste handlers, with governments to get the right policies in place. So there's just a much broader view it takes of the system to make something actually circular. And it's really challenging. You know, there's a few materials in the world that are pretty circular. Aluminum, most of it gets captured, you know, steel. But most things, like the plastics, we all know are just ending up fundamentally in the ocean or in landfills. We don't have, you know, circular stuff in place. So the kind of really heretical thing is, on some of these things, maybe there isn't a circular solution and we need to move away from that material or that way of doing things entirely, right? Some things maybe don't need as much packaging. We should not be selling them that way. Like, we're going to have to kind of question the way we've done things.
So at this point in the conversation, I imagine there might be leaders who are like, well, you know, this is all great, but they may have, you know, different concerns coming up or, you know, different roadblocks. So I just want to dive straight in here and ask you, what are the elephants in the room in this conversation? what are the things that you believe we need to move through to actually make some of these ideas a reality across the board of business all over the world?
Yeah. Well, look, there's a couple key myths, and the main one, I mean, look, I get asked almost daily, I think, for, you know, 15, 20 years, you know, in some way, something about, doesn't sustainability always cost more? And it's always the elephant in the room. It's usually identified and people point at it and say, there's the elephant. And it's just kind of a base assumption that sustainability must cost more. And it's a really weird, I think actually really weird assumption, because there's a lot of things that save money very quickly, you know, reducing energy, reducing waste. Renewables is now cheaper than, you know, fossil fuels. Like, there's things that are just clearly cheaper. It's also something we don't ask of almost any, like, again, anything else in business. We don't think about marketing and go, well, it costs more because we have to spend on marketing. And it's not like we know every dollar of marketing, how it pays off. You can't measure that, right? There's a famous line, you know, from like 100 years ago about, half my advertising is wasted, I just don't know which half. There's still some truth to that, right? You put out all these brand ideas and you put out ads and you don't really know what's working. So there's lots in business that we make investment decisions. We believe it's strategically smart for building the brand, for building the business, and we do it anyways. And I think sustainability, as I said earlier, just needs to be taken seriously in that way. So it's kind of always got this burden that that is not like other parts of business. And I think that's the kind of biggest elephant in the room. The other things that, you know, we talk about in the book about elephants are the really hard issues that companies don't really want to talk about. But I think it's difficult to say that you're having a positive impact on the world if you're not really addressing them. And it's things like money and politics and, you know, corruption. It's executive pay, which is one of my favorite / least favorite topics. It's just, it's out of control. It's taxes, companies paying taxes. You know, it seems like it's sport to try to avoid it, but then you're not really contributing to society through, you know, direct payment for our shared services, our shared existence. So there's a bunch of things that kind of need to be on the table for companies to really, I think, be taken seriously as contributors, as, you know, good citizens.
And what companies do you believe are really role modeling this well?
It's not a lot. I mean, on some level, you know, there's no company that is net positive that has got this all down. There's a bunch that have pieces of the story. Clearly, you know, because I worked with Paul and I think he was one of the most respected CEOs, and Unilever was ranked every year for, I think, the last 15 years by kind of insiders and sustainability people as the most sustainable, which is kind of dangerous in a way for the world because it's nowhere near sustainable, right? And we need to go much further. But, you know, Unilever has modeled this for a long time. Even before Paul, there was a history there of engaging on social issues. But they've modeled this kind of deep partnership behavior to address really big issues, or really working with communities to help them develop in so many places, in so many countries in the world. And that was kind of the fun of, for me, doing the research behind the book, was discovering all the things it was doing around the world that people wouldn't have known about. There's others, again, that kind of have a piece of the story. IKEA, you know, makes more energy at its stores than it needs for running the stores. So in its direct kind of what they call scope 1 and 2 emissions, it's producing more. It's actually feeding back to the grid and now selling to consumers. They're selling solar, so they're having an even bigger impact. That's net positive. That's kind of what it looks like. You have some big tech companies like Microsoft and Google that are really committed to getting to decarbonized power for their giant data centers. And they're putting up some real money, actually. I mean, as much as I say sustainability doesn't have to cost more, there's investment in new technologies that someone has to be kind of an early investor. Often that's the government. But Microsoft and some other tech companies, they're spending real money on carbon capture, because in the end, we're going to need some version of that to really control carbon emissions. And so they're spending a bunch on experiments, which is really bold. And I think, you know, real leadership. And that I think that's what it looks like, right? You got to actually take some leaps. You got to be the first. Most companies want to be fast followers now. It's kind of their famous strategy, but it just doesn't seem very exciting. You know, don't you want to be a leader? Don't you want to be kind of leading the parade?
Yeah. So, Andrew, as I mentioned before the podcast, I've been following your work for probably close to at least over a decade. I remember when I first came across your work, I think the book that you had released was Green to Gold, from memory. And, you know, as I've already said, like, the world has evolved in this space a lot, but it also feels like there's a long journey ahead of us. In your heart, are you optimistic about the possibility here?
Yeah, it's funny. I get asked that quite a bit these days, which is more of an indication of where everyone's at, maybe, than whether it matters what I think. I think it's just a very common. I get questions like, "Are we going to make it?" You know, the really dark questions. Yes, I am, and I'm not. I think, you know, it's really hard, but we can hold multiple thoughts at once that have some competing. We're in a very kind of black and white world these days. Social media, everything's made people kind of take these stands and go with their tribe and say, have this direct opinion. And we see it on, you know, Israel and Hamas right now, like these incredible, like the most complicated issues in the world throughout history. And people are just instantly going, I've got an opinion. And so I think you can hold multiple thoughts. And that's, I guess, in a way how I get through the day, which is that the problems we're facing are severe. They are extreme. Climate change is really bad. If you follow it at all, it's worse. It's worse than people realize. It's, you know, we're really destabilizing the planet and making a bunch of places uninhabitable. And that's coming. And we're not going fast enough to stop it. And it's not pessimistic to say the fact that emissions are still rising. Like, people say, are you pessimistic? I'm like, well, we're losing. That's just the fact. But that said, you know, we're also winning. We're losing slower. We're winning in the transition to renewable energy and EVs, and it's coming really, really quickly, right? So it's hard not to be optimistic about how clean the grid is going to be, how clean transportation is going to be, how clean the air is going to be when we get there. I mean, it's going to be, you know, much nicer to live. And then I'm optimistic in part about young people, right? There's a lot of dichotomies going on in young people. There's anger. There's people who are disaffected, say, I don't want to have kids. But then there's just, you know, many who just think, let's get going. We got to tackle this climate thing, and are really, really engaged. I see it at, you know, business schools. I see it at young employees at companies. They get climate change. Polls show that, you know, I think 20 to 30 year olds, whatever, you know, climate change is one of their biggest concerns, like in anything, you know, war, economy, it's climate. So that kind of gives me hope, right? You can see how well they know how to mobilize. Like, Greta Thunberg was a 16-year-old girl who got millions of people into the street in a very short time. And it's a skill set that I don't think, you know, the older ones of us, I'm a Gen X, it's a skill set we probably don't really have and don't fully understand. And so that does make me optimistic. But let's be clear, you know, we have a really long way to go. And the system fights change. You know, the antibodies against sustainability are really strong. And vested interests have a lot of money and a lot of power. So it's going to be really challenging. So I kind of hold two thoughts most of my days. I'm kind of yin-yang, you know, about it. There's that we're both winning and losing. And that's a tough thing to kind of grapple with, but I think it's the reality.
Yeah. It's interesting hearing you talk to this subject, and I've heard other people, other experts in the space speak in the same way. And I do get a feeling that in a way there needs to be more truth in the public messaging around climate. Like, it almost feels like the true impact is being dulled down a little bit, and that we need to have kind of more honest conversations in order to really wake leaders up to say, hey, this isn't just about something nice to do. Like, if we don't actually create this shift, it's going to significantly impact the planet for future generations. Do you think leaders really get the significance of net positive and the work that we're talking about here?
No, not by and large.
It's hard to
understand. It's scary, right? So easily, you know, it's not surprising that people latch on to someone's telling them, hey, maybe it's not so bad, which is kind of the message you hear still coming out of maybe the fossil fuels and the think tanks that are behind this. They'll say it's not so bad, or hey, you know, it's going to be too expensive, or EVs have a footprint. Like, there's all these kind of little, you know, statements and hurdles they put in the way. But I think very few of us, and sometimes this includes myself, you know, have really internalized what the data on climate shows and what's already happened on climate, what that shows us, you know, with the wildfires and the floods and the stronger hurricanes, all of that. It's if you really internalize it, there would have to be really, really deep change, right? And that's really hard for people to take when they're, I mean, talk about executive CEOs. They're the winners, right? In society, fundamentally,
absolutely,
right? They're very, very wealthy, more wealthy than people realize. Like, the C-suite is just many, many millions of dollars for big companies, and so they've won in the system that they know. And it's really hard to say to them, okay, that system is broken. It's actually killing us, and so you need to change it fundamentally.
Well,
it's just so very few have really internalized it. I think. They will get there, and there's more and more pressure on companies to understand these issues again because younger people get it, and they're pushing. And I think that's part of what's going to really wake up executives, and the rise of more and more regulation, you know, to force companies to measure their footprint, their carbon footprint, and put it out into the world. You know, there's just more forcing functions, including, unfortunately, the climate itself is clearly changing and costing business a lot of money, right? When a facility gets flooded or a supply chain is totally disrupted, they're kind of seeing it now. So I think it's just harder and harder to deny. But that doesn't mean they've internalized the level that you're asking, which is we really got to make our business something that serves the world, you know, in a really positive way.
Yeah.
That's still not many. Again, I think younger leaders get it better. Well, I just had a company tell me this. The head of sustainability said, as you get higher in our company, they get it less and less, which I think is kind of true of every company I know well. And that's partly just age.
Yeah.
You know, it's partly generational.
Well, and I think, you know, in listening to you, there's a recognition that the solutions we need actually require a different kind of leader, because I think a lot of the CEOs, to your point, have come up this hierarchical system that essentially puts them on top of the mountain. But that hierarchy is completely built upon the premise of having more money, more things. And, you know, so much of our society has been up until this point in time built on that hierarchy. And as you said, that hierarchy is actually what is destroying the planet, that this shift is going to require a new kind of leader with more of a circular approach and someone who's really willing to lean into this new way of thinking and to understand that to be a leader isn't necessarily about being on top or having more or having that status or leading from that place. In fact, it requires a complete dissolution of ego in a sense in order to be able to come back into a more unified way of being with people and the planet, obviously.
Well, that, and like I said before, it's a humility.
Yeah.
It's a humility that we don't really reward that much in business. I mean, think about asking people, again, who've succeeded their whole life, they're making so many millions, to say, hey, the measure of your success going forward with your company is not that your stock price and thus your options doubled, right? It's like, did you improve the well-being of everyone you touch? The money will come, right? The business will do better in the long run, but that you'd be really looking at well-being, not just money. And it sounds like you're like a radical when you say that, but I mean, how much you get paid or, you know, how much money you have past the basics, like having enough to have a decent life, it doesn't correlate with happiness, right? There's study after study showing that it doesn't give us more happiness. And so I think And it's one measure of how you're doing. Do you have a salary? Can you pay for your house and food? And, you know, it's not the only measure, right? Mm. If you ask people what really measures their lives, most people are going to say like their kids, their siblings, you know, like their relationships, the community. It's just, we kind of have gotten lost into this very narrow definition of success for business and I think for executives.
Mm. And a disconnection to the simple idea that we are nature. You know,
right.
We actually right. are nature. Like,
is it, yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah, we are, exactly.
We're a species. We're yeah. a species, and we somehow think we're outside of it.
Mm. And we build these cement towers, right. and
right. it's, that it's conquer, crazy. They conquer the world, right? Yeah. We went through. You can see it in cities around the world. We went through architecture periods of like we're going to build it wherever we want, just put whatever material we want, and not take into account the sun or the wind. Like we will dominate, right? And, you know, green buildings now, LEED buildings tend to like work with nature, work yeah. with the system more. It is strange because, you know, dominant doesn't even describe, I mean, we're so dominant, we're wiping out half the other species. And I heard a geologist recently say something that I'm still kind of getting my head around, that they believe that humans now move more materially every year than natural processes. Which if you stop and think about that for a second, natural processes is like, you know, lava and magma and like earthquakes and like, you know, we move more stuff. We are digging up and moving more material. We are so powerful. And it's both scary, but I also think if we're that powerful, we are powerful enough to destroy the world. We can absolutely use up everything and destroy it. That means we're also powerful enough to move quickly on solutions and to go faster than we thought. Like we have the power to not destroy everything and to improve the well-being of people, make sure everyone has enough within the bounds of the planet. We can do it. And we have most of the technologies and we have a lot of money, actually. Like there's a lot of money. So we can do this, right? It is about will on some level and kind of breaking this system that we're in.
Mm-hmm. So as we come to the end of the podcast, Andrew, I'd like to ask you, is there anything that you feel is really important to share with our listeners that you haven't touched on during the course of the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's often, you know, so I worked for years and have worked for years on what I consider kind of the most important issues, like climate change, I think is existential. But then in recent years, it's become clear that the more immediate existential crisis is democracy, is misinformation, right? Because without good flows of information, without a working democracy and people and representation, it's going to be pretty impossible to tackle climate change. So we have to get kind of the basics that are under threat. So I end up talking about this at some point, you know, when we get to root causes, that we have to defend democracy and we have to fight the rise of kind of, you know, autocracy around the world, and that there's this deep connection to how we're all interacting and the way social media works and the way the algorithms work and the way information flows. It's really, really tearing us apart. And we're all addicted, right, to our phones and our streams of information. And this all connects to all my work because, you know, misinformation is partly why still so many people aren't sure about climate change, right? It's like willful misinformation that you know, just gets sent around. And it's why you end up with people not wanting to get vaccinated. And you know, you get into some dangerous territory when you get anti-science, anti-quote elite, anti-knowledge, anti-expert. It's really hard to make progress in the world with that, you know, really deep distrust of information and each other. And so, I think you asked before about the questions that are bothering me. I mean, one is just how do we, you know, interact with each other better than we seem to be doing now? Like, I'm sure you've noticed, everyone's noticed, like, everyone's gotten nastier, right? Like, online comments have gotten more and more nasty, and they've started to bleed into it. People are doing it face-to-face now, which I didn't think was true not long ago. And they just seem willing to say almost anything, right? And there's not an assumption of positive intent or an assumption of someone being, you know, doing what they believe is right. You know, there's just this kind of, your hackles are raised, you know, like a dog that's like ready to, you know, to bark. It's like everyone's kind of starting from this really tense place because the world is really tense, but it's so unhealthy and it makes it hard to work together. And you know, we can't make progress on sustainability without working together.
Andrew, I just want to say it's been such a privilege to have you on the podcast. I'm incredibly inspired, not only by the work that you're doing in the world, but your ability to lean into truth-telling on this subject and to essentially inspire today's leaders and particularly the next generation of leaders to really lean in and to really approach business from a more holistic perspective, with the fundamental belief that together we absolutely do have the power to change the world. Thank you so much for joining us on the DNA of Purpose podcast. Where can our listeners find your work?
Well, first, thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the work you're doing. I'm kind of easy to find. My name, Andrew Winston, is the .com, andrewwinston.com. And, you know, you'll see there kind of what I do and links to things I write and links to books and all those things. I do a lot of speaking around the world so people can find me. And, you know, and on LinkedIn, you know, come follow and see the things I'm posting and sign up for my blog, all those kind of good things.
Excellent.
Because, you know, I'm posting things all the time. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome, and hopefully you'll be back in Australia one day speaking as well. We'd love to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us on the DNA of Purpose podcast.
Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is M-A-K-L-A-D, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.